From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with film director Wim Wenders. As a leader in the new German cinema movement, Wenders helped reestablish his country's movie industry. After making Paris, Texas, here in the United States, Wenders has returned to Germany for his new film, Wings of Desire. Also today, we find out how Hollywood censors rewrote The Maltese Falcon and A Streetcar Named Desire. Gerald Gardner's new book, The Censorship Papers, reprints memos from the censors. New Orleans pianist and singer Mac Rebenack is back for our weekly performance spot. And Ken Tucker reviews new home videos starring that eternal kid, Pee-wee Herman. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Dennis Hopper, Harry Dean Stanton, Nastassja Kinski, and Peter Falk are some of the American actors who have been directed by Wim Wenders. Wenders is one of the directors associated with the new German cinema. These directors revived the German film industry in the late 60s and 70s, following its collapse during World War II. Wenders first became known for his German films Alice of the Cities, Kings of the Road, and The American Friend. In 1978, he moved to the United States and made the films Hammett and Paris, Texas. His new film, Wings of Desire, is his first work since his recent return to Germany. It won Best Director Award at last year's Cannes Film Festival. It's a brooding film about a guardian angel who falls in love with a trapeze artist, then longs to become a person so he can experience human love. The film is inspired by a poem by Rilke. Wenders co-wrote the screenplay with Austrian playwright Peter Handke. Wings of Desire premieres in the United States next week. I spoke with Wim Wenders from the NPR Bureau in New York. I asked him why he wanted to return to Germany to make this film.
While I was gone, I lived in America actually for 8 years. The last film I made in America was Paris, Texas, and afterwards I felt like I really had done everything I wanted to do in America. And I felt I could only repeat myself if I make another American film. And also I felt a need to be working again in my own language. I had made 4 films in English, you know, and my English was getting better than my German, so.
You said you'd done everything you wanted to do in America. Were there really things, specific things that you wanted to do in America?
Yes, in a way I wanted to make a real American film. See, I'd learned filmmaking, so to speak, through the American cinema, and I came here in 78, made a few films, and I felt I really didn't get to make the film I wanted to make in the first place until I made Paris, Texas, and after that I felt I sort of had exercised my American preoccupation and I had made a film about America and in America that told what I wanted to tell. So I really felt this was the end of my mission, so to speak.
Well, Wings of Desire is shot in Berlin. Do you see Berlin differently now after having been away for so long?
Yeah, of course, that changes your point of view. If you're away for a long time, you look at a place that you were very familiar with different eyes, and that's why I wanted to make this film, because I'd been away for a long time, and I wanted to make it as long as I still was like a stranger, because that's what you become after such a long absence. So I made the film right away when I returned to Berlin.
The film is about men who are angels and who are spiritual guides, but as angels they have eternal life, but they don't have the senses that people do. They can't taste.
Yeah.
They can't see in color, they see only in black and white, and hence most of the film is shot in this kind of sepia black and white. But one of the angels gives up eternal life for love, because he falls in love with a person. You've called this your first love story. Why did you resist making a love story for so long?
Well, in a way, Paris, Texas was a love story.
That's true. That was all about frustrated love.
Although it was like the end of it.
The aftermath.
Yeah, the real love story, we only catch a glimpse of it when in between we see like a Super 8 home movie of how beautiful their little family was 4 years ago. So Paris, Texas dealt really with the end of one, but at the end of the film I thought I could really deal with it.
So these angels can't see in color, so most of the film is shot from one of the angels' perspective, and it's in this black and white. Many of your films have been in black and white. It's not as if the films you made in the 70s were made before color was invented. I don't know if you've shot a lot in black and white because it's cheaper or because you really have an affection for black and white movies.
Well, that's a myth that black and white be cheaper.
Oh,
actually,
really?
It is a luxury today. It is more expensive. It has come to that. And which is a pity because it's a really beautiful medium and it's like a lost art almost. It's a real hassle to do a film in black and white. And I mean, if you ask Woody Allen, he can tell you about the difficulties. So it's a real luxury. So it's a real choice now. And this film, and I made a few films in black and white, and a few more in colors. And this film, I choose to do it in black and white because of these angels. And, well, it's nothing I found in the Bible, but I thought angels would be seen in black and white because they don't really share any of our physical experiences. They are spiritual beings. And then I thought it'd be great if one of these angels finally decided to become a human being and then see colors for the first time and see his blood. Of course, he knows as an angel that blood is supposed to be red, but I thought, what a great experience if he can really see it and taste it.
Yeah, it's funny. He has to walk around and say to people, is this red?
Yeah.
My guest is German film director Wim Wenders, and his new film, Wings of Desire, will have its U.S. premiere next week. Now, you were born in 1945, so you came of age right after the war. You're one of the post-war filmmakers in Germany who became known as part of the new German cinema. What do you think separated you and your contemporaries, and I'll include Fassbinder and Herzog, from your predecessors in Germany?
Well, we were separated from any predecessors, period, because when we started tradition, a decent tradition to a decent German cinema had been interrupted for 30 or 40 years. Like the decent tradition that one could refer to would be the 20s. So really there was no link, and for us it was really like starting from scratch. There was no film production to speak of. So the new German cinema in the late 60s, early 70s really had to reinvent itself completely.
Had the war totally wiped out filmmaking?
The war and the 10 years before, or the 8 years before, with the Nazis, who had really completely abused the film language and used it in a propaganda sense. And then after the war, it didn't really... It took a long time to get going again, of course. And then there wasn't so much happening in German films and American movies really more or less filled the place of a national film industry. Germans didn't have much trust in their own stories anymore, so even the films made in Germany were mostly like westerns or some strange...
Genre films from another country.
Genre films from another...
In the language of another country.
Totally. So we really started from scratch, and none of us really had its tradition in the German cinema. I mean, everybody found his own tradition somewhere. And my tradition, or what I really liked and what I learned, was the American cinema, of the classic American cinema of the 40s and 50s.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that in a second, but first I'd really like to know what made the time right in the 1960s for this revival of the German cinema.
Well, maybe there was a certain need after all this absence of stories in and about Germany. There was a certain need, maybe. And also, there just happened to be a few people who turned out to be talented who were maybe encouraged by French or Italian or other European countries in their cinema. So there was just this outburst of talent. That's the way I think it has to be seen at the late 60s. Fassbinder, Herzog, Schlöndorff started a couple of years earlier. I made my first film in 1970, so it just happened all at the same time. And it did happen along with a change of the government regulations as far as film productions was concerned. The late 60s, they decided, because it was just no longer bearable, that there was, that the little film industry that was left was about to vanish too. So there was, so they decided to fund and subsidize film industry. And they subsidized anything in the beginning, I mean, even soft porn, whatever.
Really?
As long as it was a movie. So, and then, but another attitude started, and they really started to look if there was talent around, and in that time, there was some.
So the kind of personal movie that might have been overlooked in America in favor of big films or genre films was funded in Germany.
Totally, and that was on one side. There was suddenly a new economic basis, which was subsidies, government grants, and a way to coordinate these grants, which wouldn't be enough to make a movie, to coordinate them with television financing in a way that a movie would be financed partly through a television pre-sale, but TV, which is only public television in Germany, but TV would show the film only after its theatrical exploitation. So suddenly there was a possibility to make independent movies, and we used the possibility. The other thing that helped a lot was an enormous solidarity among the young filmmakers and authors, and we created our own company, the filmmakers company, about 15 of us, and we started to produce each other and with everybody's help, and also a distribution company, because at the time there was neither production nor distribution available to us.
Now, you said that the movies that really inspired you were mostly American movies. Are there specific films that stand out in your mind as being the most influential for you?
Well, my masters, in a way, were really the people that made the classical westerns in the 40s and 50s. Anthony Mann, John Ford, Howard Hawks, these were the people I really learned from.
What was it about westerns that captivated you?
Well, it was all that space and that freedom to move and to see the horizon. And there was a nice rhythm about them, and they were beautiful. They were great stories. They always made sense. Always was a happy ending. They were always the good guys.
What kind of movie theaters did you see the movies in? Were the movie theaters in a state of disrepair as the film industry had fallen apart?
Not really. The distribution system was the only thing that was in good shape, mainly because it was controlled more or less by the American majors.
Oh, so that they could have good places to distribute their films in Germany.
When we started making movies, the percentage of German films in German theaters was under 5%. Was even down to 2% at some time. Right now it's up to 10%, which might still seem ridiculously little, but it's quite a big success after all, if at one point it was almost zero. So right now we have regained, well, a little piece of the action, but at least a little.
Like a lot of French filmmakers, you started off writing film criticism. Did those analytical tools that you applied to film criticism come in handy as a filmmaker?
Yeah, I didn't really think I was going to become a filmmaker. It seemed so totally out of the question in the late 60s when I was working as a critic. I just was working as a critic, and I liked that, and that was really a good school if I look at it retrospectively. I thought I was going to become a film critic or a painter, and even after I made the first and second film, I thought, well, eventually I'm going to have to go back to writing criticism. This can't be true. I mean, at the time, it was more likely to become an astronaut than a film director.
Mm. Now, some of your peers, and I guess I'm thinking specifically of Fassbinder here, have really been preoccupied in their films, kind of obsessed in at least some of their films, with post-war Germany, with World War II, with the aftermath of the Nazis. And I think your films haven't really been preoccupied with that at all, for the most part.
That's true. I haven't really made anything about Germany. I mean, my films always, in a way, tried to get out. They're mostly road movies. I traveled a lot, and I like to work on the road and shoot on the road, so my company is even called Road Movies. So actually most of my films try to get out of Germany, and of them, of the early ones, really were concerned about the country, except for one, which is called Kings of the Road, which made a journey across the German, the West German, East German border, which is some sort of strange no man's land in the middle of the country. But other than that, my films really try to get out of Germany instead of looking into it.
Did that desire to have your films get out of Germany have to do with just the typical restlessness and wanderlust that people coming of age feel, or did it have to do with getting away from the legacy of Hitler in Germany?
Might be. I mean, difficult to really analyze it, but I really didn't feel, never felt so much like I belonged there. Strange feeling that I already had as a kid, and it might have had to do a lot with the fact that I grew up in a country where nobody really wanted to look over their shoulder, and everybody was just trying frantically to rebuild everything and not think about the past. And even if you don't really know as a kid what this is all about and you can't put your finger on it, you still feel something. That might have a lot to do with it. And then really all the fun I ever had when I was growing up, and it wasn't much fun, I can tell you that, to live in post-war Germany, but all the fun was American. First there were comic strips, and there was movies, and then there was rock and roll. So, and it was all the good things in life were American.
What was the war's effect on your family?
My father was a doctor, a surgeon, so of course during the war he was a soldier. As a doctor, and I don't think he has to make himself any reproaches. He was not a Nazi, on the contrary. He was very Catholic, so the Catholics, especially during the 30s, a lot of them were working underground and in the resistance. So, but still, of course, I mean, they had to undergo a lot of hardship. My parents were separated for 4 or 5 years. And they lost a big part of their youth or of their lives when they were young.
So your father was in the resistance?
Not really, but I mean, the background was like during the 30s, he was in a Catholic youth organization. They always had these big battles with the Hitlerjugend. And he was imprisoned a couple of times. But then he became a soldier, in a way also not to be more in trouble. And of course then, until the end of the war, he was just a soldier.
Were there issues of guilt that you had to come to terms with?
Not with my family immediately, but of course it was all over. And even my father and my mother never really liked to talk about some of the taboos, like the concentration camps. And the whole time period, they didn't talk much about it.
And have you not talked much about it as well? Or
well, I found out later.
Mm-hmm.
I talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
But even in school, it was like German history ended with the end of the 19th century, you know? You'd never read anything after that.
Right.
Even history ended with the First World War.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your life and your movies, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is German film director Wim Wenders, and his movies include Kings of the Road, The American Friend, Hammett, Paris, Texas, and a new film called Wings of Desire that's about to have its American premiere. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Film director Wim Wenders is my guest. Just one more thing I want to ask you about that. I'm wondering if you've had to almost deal more with Nazi Germany in America than you did in Germany, in that probably so many Americans are curious about, you know, what your background was and, you know, how you reconciled the aftermath of the war and all of that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but of course, I mean, that happened a few times while I lived here. But then again, I also had a feeling that somehow, this was now 40 years later, the issue wasn't that burning anymore.
Mm-hmm. You first came to America in 1978 to work on to direct the film Hammett, which was produced by Francis Ford Coppola.
Yeah.
And was that movie the reason why you came to America? Or had you come here and then gotten the chance to make the movie?
No, it was that movie in the first place. They invited me to come over and to discuss this project called Hammett that was after my film The American Friend with Dennis Hopper, which they had liked, and they thought I'd be a good guy to do this detective story, Hammett.
After making all these really, personal films, you made Hammett, which in a lot of ways is a genre film. It's about, loosely based on the life of Dashiell Hammett, but, you know, he gets involved in a caper in it. So it becomes a genre film. Was that a good opportunity for you, having grown up really enjoying American genre films?
Yeah, I mean, I was really familiar with Hammett's work long ago. He was one of my heroes and was one of my favorite literature was Hammett, Chandler, Ross MacDonald. But I always thought Hammett was really the master of that genre. So I was really excited, and I liked the project a lot. It took some time. It was a difficult movie to make because, in a way, it was between all sorts of genres. It was a detective story, and at the same time, it was a film about a writer. So it took quite some time, but it was great to work on it. It was great to work in Hollywood.
Now, the movie was not commercially successful, but I think it's really developed a cult following. I've read rumors of that the film ran out of money, that Francis Ford Coppola shot part of the film. How much truth is there in that?
No, Francis didn't shot any of it. I mean, as the producer, he was, of course, responsible for the thing. We wanted to do the whole thing in the beginning in San Francisco on location, and actually we shot a lot there too. And then the film was almost finished, and we changed the script several times. Then we edited it, and the studio who backed the film, Orion, thought it was not fast enough and not enough action in it. It was too much like a film about the writer, too much a biography and not enough of the genre film. So we rewrote it, and we reshot a lot of it on stage in Zoetrope Studios in Hollywood. But I shot all of it, and Francis was supervising.
Was this a bad experience for you, coming from the freedom that you had with very personal films that were funded in Germany to going to Hollywood, where there's all these budget considerations and it has to be fast-paced with lots of action, you know, all the things that you were mentioning?
Well, it's obviously a different world, but, I mean, I knew that I wasn't that innocent and naive. I knew that it was going to be different to work inside the studio system, but that's what I wanted to do, because all these films that I really admired and all these filmmakers, also these European and German filmmakers who had come to America in the 20s and 30s had worked under these conditions. So I knew what was going to happen. I knew that there was a certain confrontation between the movies I had been able to make before, produced myself in Germany and working under studio conditions. But it was an important experience in my life.
I want to ask you about Paris, Texas. Earlier, you said that you really loved Westerns, especially when you were growing up, and you loved the expanse of the areas that they were shot in. Mm-hmm. Paris, Texas is shot in Texas, and it opens with the scene of Harry Dean Stanton walking along this endless railroad track, and there's nothing in sight on the horizon, and it gives this real sense of loneliness and emptiness. Was that in any way a kind of homage to the Westerns that you loved?
Yeah, in a way, of course. The landscapes in Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, where we shot, really looked sometimes like the spaces, the open spaces in the West, in John Ford's films. And Harry Dean, in the beginning of Paris, Texas, really comes out of Mexico and he crosses the border illegally like a wetback. And so I really liked working there with the light and the incredible colors of the American West.
I think it's so interesting that you, as a German film director, so beautifully captured the American West, you know?
No, I don't think it's rather normal that one would really like and love this.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, and I had great help with my cinematographer and all the crew, and I think we really succeeded in capturing some of the beauty of the American West.
Do you think that your sense of film language and the pacing of your movies has changed at all by your experiences making movies in America?
It has changed. On the other hand, working for 8 years in America, I realized that, after all, I was not going to become an American filmmaker. And that really, I came to terms working in America and being here that I was really a European filmmaker and a German in my heart. So that's the reason why I went back. I realized I was never going to become an American director. It was just not my world in a way. And also making movies the way they're made in America was just not what I was really best at, and I felt I could do my best much better.
What specifically did you feel like you couldn't fit into or you couldn't express in an American film?
Well, there's one main big difference, which is that an American movie really happens before you even start shooting. The film is designed and conceived from A to Z before you really go into production. There's storyboards and lots of work on the script with a lot of different people. So once you start the film, it's almost finished. I mean, the whole creative work is done. The shooting is just the execution of it. It's already a designed product before you even start. And that's not really the way I was used to work, and that's not really the way I want to work. For me, a film is something you really have to find out about while you do it, and you have to be able to react and change it as you go. So, and most of my films, of course, were scripted, but I changed enormously. I shot them when I was producing them myself in chronological order so that I could always change around, and even Paris, Texas was totally different when we finally made it than it was had been scripted before. And I prefer that method of openness, and that leaves more space to improvisation as well as spontaneity.
When you returned to Germany, did you feel that German filmgoers and German directors were really glad to have you back?
Well, somehow, yeah. Somehow I felt I was welcome. Some people, of course, said, hey, now he's coming back. He's been away for 8 years. So, I mean, in a way, some people made a certain reproach out of the fact that I've been away for 8 years. Mm. But then most of them were rather happy, especially as Rainer is dead and Werner Herzog has been away also and still is away. Schlönow is now working in America, so out of a sudden I was almost the only one left of the initial new German cinema.
Are you working on a new movie now?
Yep, I'm working on a science fiction film called Till the End of the World, which will shoot all over the planet, actually, in 17 countries on all 6 continents.
And wow.
It's a film that takes place in the year 2000, and I'm already in pre-production now.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life
thank
and your
you,
movies.
Terry.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
My guest has been German film director Wim Wenders, and his movies include Kings of the Road, The American Friend, Hammett, and Paris, Texas. His new film, Wings of Desire, will have its American premiere next week. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with James Adams. He's the defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London, and he's just written a book about the role of covert special forces in fighting terrorism around the world. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. When does a kiss go from being romantic to being dirty? When is a loincloth ample enough? For nearly 40 years, the film industry's censors in the Hays office dictated the answers to those questions. Coming up, I speak with Gerald Gardner, whose new book reprints censorship letters from the office's files. Also, Mac Rebinac, the New Orleans pianist who also goes by the name Dr. John, plays a couple of tunes from Mardi Gras. And it's great news for kids and lots of adults. Pee-wee's Playhouse is now out on home video cassette. Our critic Ken Tucker has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. Soviet General Secretary Mikhail Gorbachev today charged President Reagan with sermonizing to the Soviet Union on domestic and foreign policy issues. His complaint was delivered during a three-hour meeting in Moscow with Secretary of State George Shultz. Details from NPR's Ann Cooper.
Shultz is in Moscow making plans for next month's summit between Gorbachev and Reagan. Gorbachev's sharp remarks, reported by the official TASS news agency, appeared to be a warning to Reagan that the president should not come to Moscow expecting to win major concessions on issues dividing the two superpowers. Gorbachev indicated that if Reagan continues to repeat old positions, there will be few accomplishments during the summit. He charged that the United States is interfering in Soviet domestic issues and warned that the Kremlin might retaliate by ending the recent warming trend in U.S.-Soviet relations. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega today proposed new talks with the United States. Ortega suggested the resumption of direct talks on May 15th in Manzanillo, Mexico. U.S. and Sandinista government officials met several times in Manzanillo until 1985, when the talks were broken off by the United States. Also today, the Nicaraguan government threatened to call an emergency session of the U.N. Security Council. President Ortega has accused the United States of violating the Guatemala peace accords by delivering humanitarian aid to the Contras through the Agency for International Development. Ortega claims the nine-point agreement stipulates that any aid must be brought to the rebels by a neutral organization. A U.S. embassy spokesman in Honduras today denied the aid deliveries violate the Guatemala accords. The financially strapped PTL ministry suffered another blow today when the Internal Revenue Service revoked its tax-exempt status. Ellie Shepard of member station WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina, reports.
Saying that PTL did not operate within the guidelines of its original charter, the IRS today announced that contributions to the television ministry are no longer tax-deductible. PTL has been struggling to meet a May 15th Chapter 11 reorganization deadline, and the IRS ruling could have serious consequences. The IRS has been seeking revocation for months, but was prevented from doing so by a preliminary court injunction. That injunction was lifted earlier this week by a court in Richmond. The IRS contends that some PTL officials violated the charter by making excessive profits from the ministry, and that much of PTL's business income was not in keeping with the tax-exempt status. Today's ruling does not affect contributions made in the past. They remain fully deductible. For National Public Radio, I'm Ellie Shepard in Charlotte, North Carolina.
First Lady Nancy Reagan underwent a mammogram today that showed no recurrence of the breast cancer she suffered last year. Mrs. Reagan's left breast was removed last October, shortly after a mammogram discovered a small malignant tumor. Today's test was negative. A ship tentatively identified as a Greek-owned tanker was found broken in half and burned off the coast of Newfoundland today. Rescuers say they found no survivors or signs of the crew, but Coast Guard Officer Larry Lawrence said the searchers aren't discounting the possibility of finding survivors.
There is a life raft missing from the vessel, so we are hoping, and I do emphasize hoping, that the people on board got into it and got away from the area. At this time, we don't have any idea on the vessel or exactly what it was carrying or how many people were on the crew.
Right now, there is no information about what caused the tanker to crack. Government scientists are planning to ask the Food and Drug Administration to take a popular acne medicine off the market. They say Accutane can cause birth defects if taken by pregnant women. The Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta says it will also recommend further restrictions on the distribution of the drug. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Over the past few weeks, our performer-in-residence, Mac Rebenack, who's also known as Dr. John, has been sharing some of the music of his native New Orleans with us. Today he has some tunes from the celebration that helped make New Orleans famous.
Right now I'd like to play a little Mardi Gras Indian music of New Orleans. Every year at the Mardi Gras, the Indians have been doing this song forever, and all the Indian tribes in New Orleans, the Yellow Pocahontas, the Young Sons of Geronimo, the Wild Chapatulas, all the Indians do it, the Wild Magnolias, all the tribes do this song in particular thing called Iko Iko.
What the doctor say, you got the Giacomo Finale now. But I go, I go, I go, I go, ande. Giacomo Fino, ande. Giacomo Finale now. My's by bar, so yours by bar, they were sitting along the bayou. My's by bar, so yours by bar, I'm gonna set your tail on fire, you. Talking about here now. Here now, I go, I go, ande. Jack and Mofino, ande. Jack and Mofino, ande now. When I look at my queen all dressed in red, I go, I go, ande. Well, I bet you $5 she gon' kill you dead. Jack and Mofino, ande. Well, maybe cheat me, got a golden crown. I go, I go, ande. And I bend my knee, but I won't bow down. Jack and Mofina, I need ya. Talking about here now, here now. I go, I go, I need. Jack and Mofino, I need. Jack and Mofina, I need ya. With an engine red feather in me head, Jack and Mofina, I need. Well, I remember that morning, I remember it well. I go, I need. I remember that morning when Brother John fell. Jack and Mofina, I need. When I Curry died on the battlefield, I go, I need. Then we bend and won't turn, won't bow, won't kneel. Jack and Mofina, I need. By hit now, hit now. I go, I go, ande. Oh, Jack and Mofino, ande. Jack and Mofino, ande.
Keeping in the Mardi Gras tradition of New Orleans music, I'd like to do you a little thing that was written by Earl King for the great Professor Longhair. I had the pleasure of recording on the Gumbo album called Big Chief. And this was a very inspirational tune, as well as a song that was picked up by all the Mardi Gras Indian tribes of New Orleans. And it goes a little something like this. Morning come, I don't live it burning down.
have it burning down. Find a water back of town. Big Chief. I'm gonna leave you with a little thing we do every year too, called a mess around, and we have a lot of fun with the Kai Kai blues mixed in with it.
Mac Rebinac plays more music of New Orleans on his album Dr. John's Gumbo, which was reissued last year. This is Fresh Air. From 1934 to 1968, the motion picture industry followed a code that opened with this warning: no picture shall be produced which will lower the moral standards of those who see it. Hence, the sympathy of the audience shall never be thrown to the side of crime, wrongdoing, evil, or sin. The code was enforced by the Hays Office, which acted as Hollywood's board of censors. Scripts and footage had to be submitted to the Hays Office, and in turn, the censors would write letters to the studios specifying necessary changes or deletions. Many of those letters have been reprinted in the new book, The Censorship Papers, by Gerald Gardner. He also wrote the CBS TV special, America Censored.
I've always been intrigued and enraged and amused by the fact that the most popular and the most famous movies of our time, from Gone with the Wind to Casablanca, have really passed through a sieve that has sort of protected the public against the facts of life.
Let's turn to the story of Casablanca. Now, you reprint some of the memos that the Hays Office censors sent to the filmmakers of Casablanca. And I'd like you to read one of the memos that was sent to the people making Casablanca.
You may recall in Casablanca, there is a flashback in which we see Ingrid Bergman and Humphrey Bogart in Paris, you know, in years past. And the script written by the Epstein brothers showed that they had gone beyond merely kissing in that scene, and the censors, which did not recognize the existence of anything beyond kissing, wrote the following memo in part: "Gentlemen, the present material seems to contain a suggestion of a sexual affair between Rick and Ilsa," those are the characters played by Bogart and Bergman, "which would be unacceptable if it came through in the finished picture. We believe this could possibly be corrected by replacing the fade-out with a dissolve and shooting the succeeding scene without any sign of a bed."
Why was the production code first established? This was when, in 1929?
Yes, it was established because there was really quite a firestorm of criticism throughout certain parts of the public, Terry, among the editorial writers, the women's clubs, the clergy, the Congress. That's quite an impressive constituency, as you can see. And they were objecting to all the sexual material that was in the motion pictures. The Hollywood movie makers were fearful that Congress would pass a law setting up a national censorship board. Congress was very close to doing that. And so they said, if Congress is going to do it, we'll do it ourselves, and we'll keep the censorship in-house. And they set up the Hayes office.
Was there a list of words specified in the code that you weren't allowed to say in a movie?
Oh, yes. It, of course, the words, like, obligatory words like hell and damn were forbidden. But even somewhat innocent-sounding words like madam or hot woman or nuts, or the word nuts, interestingly enough, was considered absolutely taboo. Even when in a very innocent context, Betty Davis once offered a tray of nuts to George Brent in a movie, and the censors cut it out and forced her to say almonds. So they were very careful about words that now seem quite innocent.
In the film Pal Joey, which had a score by Rodgers and Hart, at least one song had its lyrics changed by the Hayes office. You reprint the lyrics that were considered objectionable in your book, and I'm going to ask you to either recite or sing the objectionable lyrics from Bewitched, Bothered, and Bewildered.
The ones you're referring to, the original lyrics were vexed again, perplexed again, thank God I can be oversexed again. Romance, fini, your chance, fini, those ants that invaded my pants, fini. I'll sing to him each spring to him and worship the trousers that cling to him. And in the introduction to the song, the gal sings a line called, he's a laugh, but I love it because the laugh's on me. All of these lines were either eliminated or laundered to remove any of the wit and any of the sexual connotation.
To give us a sense of the kind of memos that filmmakers were receiving, would you read the memo on page 202 about A Streetcar Named Desire?
Yeah. Now, the work of Tennessee Williams was particularly vulnerable to the censors. I mean, Tennessee Williams, as you know, has always explored the sexual, the darker side of life. He's dealt with adultery and homosexuality, promiscuity, rape. And what you're referring to on A Streetcar Named Desire, this is part of a memo that was sent by the Hayes office to Warner Brothers, the producers of the movie version of the Broadway play. Says, gentlemen, we set forth the following 3 points as representing the 3 principal problems posed by this material in A Streetcar Named Desire under the censorship code. 1, the script contains an inference of sex perversion. That's, of course, what they meant to homosexuality. This principally has reference to the character of Blanche DuBois' young husband. There seems little doubt that this young man was homosexual. 2, there seems to be an inference of a type of nymphomania with regard to the character of Blanche herself. Her peculiar and neurotic attitude towards sex, and particularly to sex attraction for young boys, it has about it an erotic flavor that seems to verge on perversion of a sort. 3, the third problem has reference to the rape, which is both justified and unpunished. All sins had to be punished in the movies. I saw A Streetcar Named Desire on TV, Terry, just the other night, and it was brought home to me how very carefully, how successful they were in eliminating those first 2 points. And those were elements, and mind you, that film was made well into the 50s, and though it was a very moving film with Brando and Vivian Leigh, it was not nearly as dramatic as it was when in its original form on Broadway.
In 1968, the Hayes office and the production code were replaced by the new rating system.
That's correct.
What was the reason for the Hayes office basically being shut down?
Well, there were 2 or 3 reasons, Terry, which combined to really sound the death knell for the Hayes office. One was the growing competition of television. The movies felt they had to be able to present something that you couldn't get on television, and that was often sex, and they were being impeded by the Hayes office. The second thing was foreign films were increasingly competitive with them. They were presenting much more mature themes. And, of course, the Supreme Court along the way had given motion pictures the same First Amendment rights that the press had. And in 68, the Hayes office breathed its last breath and was replaced by the rating system, which is a lot more flexible in its ways.
Does your interest in censorship relate at all to any experiences you've had with censors in your work in the entertainment world?
Well, yes, it has in a way. I must say, in producing television shows, I was constantly struck by the fact that certain elements that seemed somewhat innocuous to me were censored by the standards and practices people at the networks. And censorship in films, this is not really just a nostalgic subject, Terry. Censorship is still very much with us. You know, Senator Albert Gore and his wife were in the forefront of an effort to censor rock lyrics a year or two ago. There are still libraries throughout the United States where books like The Diary of Anne Frank and the works of Arthur Miller and Mark Twain are censored. There's still censorship on television, on MTV. There's censorship in government. You know, when troops went into Grenada, the journalists were kept out for a few days. So censorship is still very much with us. And when you examine the works of, the censors throughout the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, you know, you really see just, Arthur Schlesinger said, censorship is folly in the pursuit of virtue. You just see how much folly there really was.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Gerald Gardner is the author of The Censorship Papers.
Romance, Finney. Your chance, Finney. Those ants that invaded my pants, Finney. Bewitched, bothered, and bewildered.
Ella Fitzgerald sings Rodgers and Hart on Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, we have an eyewitness account of Monday's attack in the Persian Gulf from reporter Richard Pyle, who was a pool correspondent. He's now back and will tell us about it. Also, we're following the French presidential election, the first round of which takes place this weekend, and Vera Frankel will give us a set of profiles of all the candidates who are contesting it this year. In addition to that, a report from Ann Cooper in Moscow in an interview with American Sovietologist Marshall Goldman about the rift, or is there one, between Mikhail Gorbachev, Soviet leader, and the number two man on his Politburo, Igor Ligachev. Various reports have him either demoted or being given a short vacation.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Saturday morning television hasn't been the same since Pee Wee Herman's show premiered in 1986. Pee Wee's Playhouse is a celebration of eccentricity. Of course, the biggest oddball of them all is Pee Wee himself. There's a new home video series of some of his shows, and critic Ken Tucker has a review.
I know of very few adults who will admit to liking Pee Wee Herman, and Pee Wee certainly doesn't make it easy. He wears too much rouge, he squeals like a spoiled brat, and if someone suggests he's being immature, chances are he'll say, "I know you are, but what am I?" However, a fair number of grown-ups, as well as millions of children, have discovered that Pee Wee Herman is one of the best reasons to watch television these days. Pee Wee's Playhouse is the wittiest, wonkiest show on the air, and those of you who can't get your eyes open by 10 a.m. on Saturdays are in luck. Three volumes of Pee Wee's Playhouse have just been released on cassette by High Tops Video, and they qualify as first-rate guilty pleasures. Pee Wee's Playhouse presumes a baby boomer's knowledge of kid vid ranging from Captain Kangaroo to Soupy Sales. It's Pee Wee's greatest triumph to succeed on two levels simultaneously. As a show children can take at face value, and as an impressively complex spoof of children's television that can leave grown-ups slack-jawed with admiration. Pee-wee's Playhouse never talks down to kids and never plays it simple. The show teems with characters, including a chair named Cherry and a pterodactyl named Terry. Every episode includes a secret word. Whenever you hear the secret word, you're supposed to scream real loud, which is one reason some late-sleeping parents hate Pee-wee on Saturday mornings. But Pee-wee has redeeming social value. Here, for example, he teaches us how to enjoy a salad as a snack time meal.
If you don't have a salad bar at home, just ask a grown-up to cut up some salad chunk like I did. First stop, the leafy stuff, lettuce. It's important that everything from the garden be washed well. Next, over to the carrots. What's this? Looks like a brain! Cauliflower! Now, mushrooms! Sure hope these aren't the poison kind. Just kidding.
Pee-wee's Playhouse combines improvisational set pieces like that with crazy props and good animation to keep you dazzled throughout each tape's trio of half-hour episodes. Other new video cassette releases include the late Sam Peckinpah's wildest movie, Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia. This 1974 film starring Kris Kristofferson, Warren Oates, and Gig Young is a hyperbolic bloodbath, but it's also funny and beautiful, with a few of Peckinpah's most gorgeous lyrical scenes. There's also I've Heard the Mermaid Singing, Canadian director Patricia Rosema's debut, about an insecure secretary who starts to take charge of her life by living out her fantasies. Another intriguing effort by a first-time director is 3 O'Clock High, overseen by Phil Janoux. He was a Steven Spielberg discovery who managed the now almost impossible feat of making an amusing high school comedy. The plot is strictly post-Animal House, but Phil Janoux managed to cram his movie so full of clever shots and sight gags that you almost don't mind the gross-out humor. Remember, I said almost.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, I'll speak with stand-up comic Kate Clinton. As a lesbian and feminist, Clinton started out playing women's festivals. Now she plays comedy clubs around the country. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will pay tribute to the late bandleader and arranger Gil Evans. And television critic David Bianculli will review China Beach, ABC's new series about women in the Vietnam War. So I hope you can join us, and we'd love to hear from you. Drop us a line if you have a chance at Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.